From Michigan Radio, you are listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, running a school district in Michigan.
There are very few things now that a local school board can decide because most everything is legislated.
There's an agenda by the leadership in Lansing about what they want to do with public education, and part of that is to get more of it into privatized schools.
What's in the heart and soul of an entrepreneur?
It takes passion, it takes drive, it takes commitment, maybe a little bit of crazy. In a good way.
Plus, Ann Arbor singer-songwriter Laith El-Saadi on Life After The Voice.
I might not be playing for free at the local bar anymore because I'm hoping to kind of elevate my status as an artist to being able to play more of my own music to people that want to listen instead of get drunk and talk over me.
Those stories and more today on Stateside, but first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The idea that you're being seen by 15, 16 million people when you step on there is crazy. That's more put together in one shot than my entire performing career.
Coming up, Ann Arbor musician Laith El-Saadi on what it was like being thrust into the national spotlight on NBC's The Voice. But first, how do you decide if a so-called failing school should shut down? And is there a right way to do it? Three Detroit charter schools closed their doors for good at the end of this school year. One of those was the Allen Academy, one of Detroit's very first charters. As Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick reports, its closure leaves a wake of upheaval.
This ornate red brick complex on Detroit's west side is unmistakably an old Catholic church. St. Teresa of Avila closed in the 1980s. Since 1999, it's been Allen Academy. But Allen Academy is now closing too. As early summer light poured through the stained glass windows, a few people milled around the old nave.
The idea was that parents could and kids could come in here. They could meet with all the various schools. They could find a program that would match the kind of learner that they are, and they could find a good spot for next year.
That's Buddy Morehouse, a spokesman for the Michigan Association of Public School Academies. They put together this enrollment fair after Allen Academy's charter authorizer, Ferris State University, declined to renew its contract. The reason given? Consistently low academic performance. Morehouse admits that closing a school is always tough, but he says it's the right choice.
The kids are going to be better off if they move to one of these schools. It's really that simple.
Sandra Martin was there promoting the Detroit Merit Academy. They have a handful of open seats, but Allen Academy had nearly 900 K-12 students. Martin says it could be tough for all of them to find good schools on such short notice.
It seems like ill timing to me. I actually didn't even know the school was closing. Apparently their staff didn't either until a week prior to.
A lot of Allen parents didn't know it was coming either, though they'd known for months that it could happen. Iris Stewart had two kids at Allen. She says they kept getting conflicting information.
The coach said that they're going to be, you know, we okay, we good. And then I see it on Instagram, and I'm like, oh my goodness, like really?
Yes, she got official word of the closing from her son, who saw it on Instagram. Stewart has mixed feelings about it. She thinks the school may have run its course, but she's not happy about scrambling to find new schools at the last minute. Allen parent Tamara Brown was prepared, though. She's already enrolled her son in several other schools. But Brown says Allen Academy meant a lot to her. Her daughter graduated from the school and is about to graduate from college. While Brown admits things had gone downhill, she thinks it had the capacity to rebuild.
I don't think shutting it down was the best way to go, only especially this is a struggling community, and this was pretty much almost the only school that was within this area.
Allen Academy's final reauthorization review report fleshes out just how things went so wrong. It shows a school that was in serious trouble and knew it. The school board made some drastic moves to try and reverse course, cutting some ties with the school's long-running for-profit management agency. But the result was chaos. The school rapidly went from surplus to deficit. Staff left in droves, with many vacancies filled by uncertified teachers. The superintendent resigned, and the school's already poor test scores fell to rock bottom. Charter school proponents say this is an example of accountability in practice. They point out that low-performing traditional public schools almost never shut down, but charters have the flexibility to make that happen. But researchers say very few charter schools close just for academic reasons. Gary Miron has studied this for years. He's an education professor at Western Michigan University.
Those schools often happen to be the schools that are performing poorly, but the thing that kind of starts the process often isn't their poor performance.
Miron thinks Allen probably should have closed years ago. but he says there's a lot we just don't know about how best to make that decision or how to handle the closing process. There are no mandated transition times, no real state guidelines about how to close a school. And Miron says when it comes to charter schools in particular, the question is not just what happens to families and communities, but what happens to the school and its assets.
Oops, we thought this was a public school. It's privately owned. The equipment, the desk, everything has been purchased with public dollars, but it's all private property.
Allen Academy's board must create a winding up plan spelling all that out. But it still leaves hundreds of families in limbo without a neighborhood anchor of nearly a century. They have to hope that one school official was wrong with this prediction, that if you close Allen Academy, quote, you sign a death certificate for the community. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunity is
the next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
The next idea gives us a space to explore ways to boost innovation and entrepreneurism in Michigan, getting businesses started, seeing them grow, and then giving a helping hand to the next entrepreneur with a dream. Andy Thomas and his Starving Artist Brewery in Ludington is a perfect example of all of this. Andy won $50,000 last year in the Momentum Business Plan competition in Mason County. And this year, Andy is mentoring the candidates and the eventual winner. Andy Thomas, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Starving Artist Brewery. Was this a career change for you?
It was. I was a gallery owner downtown Ludington for nearly 10 years, and we were kind of deciding what we wanted to be when we grew up, and the brewery ended up kind of becoming a realistic venture after a little bit of pipe dreaming and a little bit of planning.
What drew you to the idea of a brewery, Andy?
I've always been a huge Michigan beer enthusiast and avid home brewer, and so it was one of those things that any home brewer, their dream is always to get into a brewing situation professionally. I think it's fair to say, at least.
And how long has Starving Artist been up and running?
We just celebrated our one-year anniversary, so we are brand new.
And then you got that big jump from that $50,000 prize from the competition, from the Momentum Business Plan competition. What did that mean for your company?
Wow. I really believe that it launched us 2 years into the future, overnight. And we've been going high speed ever since.
How's the business grown?
Grown in production. It grew a little bit in size. We were able to add on a little bit more space so that we would have a little bit more storage room, hopefully eventually a canning operation, that kind of thing. But it increased our production by double.
So for a fledgling business, something like this $50,000 prize is a game changer.
Oh, it's huge. I don't know many people, even big or small, that kind of money doesn't change the way you do business. Absolutely.
And here you are mentoring this year's crop of candidates in the Momentum Business Plan competition in Mason County. What does that mean? What will you be doing with them?
As far as I've been informed, you know, I'm just going to be there to kind of help them. I would say maybe say what things were great. And, you know, the way that the $50,000 really helps the business, and perhaps maybe ways that in hindsight we could have done it maybe a little bit differently and help them make really, really educated decisions and make this $50,000 be the most impactful that it can be.
What do you look for when you think of someone who can take an idea, plant that seed, and make it grow into a business? What does it take to do that in your book?
You know, I think most people with the entrepreneurial spirit really do have what it takes. I think, you know, it takes passion, it takes drive, it takes commitment, maybe a little bit of crazy in a good way. But I really think that as far as somebody that I would be looking at as a candidate would be somebody who really is passionate about what they're trying to do, somebody that is willing to kind of jump off the deep end and learn to swim, you know, as they go along.
How important do you think it is for people that have launched their businesses, so entrepreneurs that are making it happen, how important is it for them to reach back and lend a helping hand to the next crop?
I feel that it is absolutely one of the most important things that somebody with experience can do. When we were starting our business at the beginning with the gallery, when we actually bought a business that was established in the 70s as a little art supply store, and when we started, we took advantage of the local chapter of SCORE. And having that feedback and that input, somebody to help you dot the I's and cross the T's, and somebody that works as an accountability partner of sorts, I think that there's a wealth of information that's more valuable than money. And so I believe that it's extremely, extremely important.
And certainly the Momentum Business Plan Competition is an example of established businesses helping newcomers, in this case with this $50,000 cash prize. Can people still apply?
Yes, I believe that they're still taking applications. You can go to Luddington.org/momentum to get more information. I personally believe that the mentors that come along with the package, with the board of judges and the business people that put this together, I believe that their input and their leadership, or at least guidance, is worth as much, if not more, than the prize.
Andy Thomas is the owner of Starving Artist Brewing in Luddington. And after getting that $50,000 prize in the first ever Momentum Business Plan Competition in Mason County last year, Andy will be part of the process this year, mentoring this year's candidates. Andy, great energy, great ideas. Thank you so much for sharing them with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
The battle is raging on the ground below you. North Vietnamese soldiers have outnumbered and surrounded American soldiers. You've been flying your helicopter in and out of that hot zone all day, bringing in reinforcements, taking out the dead and wounded, and then finally following the order to get dozens of American troops back to safety. And then you learn 8 soldiers were left behind. Without a second thought, you turn that Huey around and you speed back to the battle zone. Mortar rounds and bullets smash your windshields, damage your chopper, but you manage to get airborne and you bring every soldier home. That battle in May 1967 is why Charles Kettles of Ypsilanti was at the White House today. The retired Army Lieutenant Colonel received the Medal of Honor from President Obama. Charles Kettles says he was just doing his job. You don't think about yourself.
I don't think you have the luxury of being concerned about your own welfare. You've got 8 troops down there. The solution was obvious. If I left them there for 15 minutes, they would have been prisoners or dead.
After the ceremony, President Obama tweeted, 44 men came home because Chuck Kettles believed we leave no man behind. That's America at our best. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Earlier this year, I spoke with Ann Arbor singer-songwriter Laith El-Saadi. You may have seen him play at little bars or music venues around the state. But after he appeared on NBC's The Voice, now the rest of America knows what Michigan music fans have known for years.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane.
What's your name, man?
My name is Laith El-Saadi. I'm 38, and I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
And that blind audition on NBC's The Voice had stars Blake Shelton and Adam Levine raving about Laith's voice.
Dude, you're just such a great singer.
Thank you so much.
First of all, the control of your big voice, you have just as much control up high as you do down low. You're awesome. And
Thank you.
You shred like a maniac, and I love that.
And as a member of Team Adam, Laith El-Saadi went on to finish 4th, back from The Voice and with us here at Michigan Radio. Laith, it is a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Congratulations. You know, and I think about this, you've had 20-something years performing. You got your degree from U of M in?
Jazz studies and guitar and bass.
And you have been literally one of Michigan's hardest working musicians. Why did you decide to audition for The Voice?
Wow. You know, people had always suggested that I should do it, and I guess I always thought it would potentially be good, but I wasn't willing to like wait around a building for days. And I said, you know, well, if they ever come to me or if they send me an email, then maybe I'll do it. And that happened. They actually sent me an email and I got a VIP audition with a time and stuff. And so I didn't have to cancel gigs to do it. And I was like, you know, this worked out really well for Josh Davis. It worked out really well for Michelle Shamwell, who, you know, we've had good Michigan representation on the show. And I got to say, first of all, I don't believe in music as a competition in general. And I also just think it's a strange platform to begin with, to be on essentially a game show for it. But I think The Voice is actually the best out of them in terms of they represent people well. They actually are really going for more talented people and generally better singers. And it's a good pool of people. And I think Josh Davis proved to me that you could maintain your integrity as an artist and be on the show. And I feel like I didn't really have to bend too much. I mean, I think maybe I was difficult for them to deal with this season. And people say I broke the mold, whatever. I was able to pretty much stay true to myself.
Yes. And there you are representing Michigan, as you say right there. I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan. As you walked out there and started singing on that blind audition night, did you in your heart expect chairs to turn around or did you not care? Did you just say, here I am? What was going on in your mind?
Well, I was hoping that chairs would turn, and I guess I got pretty far into the song, and they hadn't. And so I went from really just thinking I'm going to do the best I can to, like, my heart was sinking a little bit because I'm like, you know, I feel like I'm doing pretty good on this, and they're not turning around. And there was this moment where I literally was thinking, while I'm singing this song, I have to, like, really just make this the best I can, because either way, this is going to be my biggest exposure on network television that I've ever had, even if I'm going home. And fortunately, I just decided to push through and give, you know, the performance my all. And after the fact, of course, you see that Adam and Blake were kind of looking at each other, seeing who was going to hit first and stuff, and it seems like more deliberate that they were going to. But God, I mean, you know, I didn't see what was going on. So my heart did kind of sink halfway through the bridge when I'm just like, yeah, they're not going to turn around, and I still have to make this a good performance.
But they did turn, and you wound up working with Adam. Why'd you pick him?
I think Adam had the most experience with rock and roll and just generally with the music that I have gravitated towards. And that's not to say that I think he's rock and roll. I mean, Maroon 5 is definitely more of a pop thing, but I think he listens to a lot of the music that I listen to. And I think that, you know, he's definitely a big Beatles fan. He's definitely a big blues fan. He likes Sinatra. He likes all this stuff. He's a very diverse guy. And I think, you know, he gets a lot of where I was coming from. That said, I'm kind of an Americana guy, and I think the blues is a big part of country, and it wasn't like I thought Blake would have been a bad choice, but I think Adam's a better guitar player. Adam had a little more concept of where I was coming from, and I do think I would have potentially had the guitar taken away from me by the other coaches. You know, maybe not Pharrell if he had picked me, but okay. I had to choose between Adam and Blake. So.
Well, and there you are doing it on the moment after the chair is turned, but you probably have thought it through in your mind if the chairs turn around, here's what I think.
Yeah,
I really
thought I was going to do Adam. I mean, you know, and I'm not going to lie, there were issues also about, you know, me being an Arab American and wondering how the Middle America country contingent was going to receive Laith Al-Saadi versus Adam and, you know, the Rock and Rollers, which might be a little more receptive. And, you know, it does have an impact because there's, you know, even still a certain percentage of people that are going to make terrorist jokes and things like that on YouTube or things like that under my name. And it's like, you know, I didn't really necessarily want to expose myself to more of that.
And how did it go ultimately through the process?
Really good. Really good. I mean, honestly, like, I was expecting a lot more hate because, of course, you know, with adoration is going to come that. And it's like, you know, people think things that you don't even put out there. Like, people claim that I was using the show as an opportunity to sell my own records. Like, I never brought up my own music. Pharrell bringing up my music on that show was totally unexpected to me. It was totally unprecedented. It was awesome. I mean, it was a great push, but, like, I actually never still brought up my own music. It wasn't ever manipulated by me as a platform to do anything but be a contestant on it. And I feel very lucky that they embraced that and that they asked me questions about it and chose to give some attention. But, I mean, you know, but, like, we have so much footage that is taped, you know, that they're not picking from. So what's seen is, like, you know, what, 1/30th of what they have, maybe, you know, in terms of interviews and stuff like that. And it's obviously heavily edited and stuff. So I think anything that was represented on the show is very calculated and thought about.
I have to contrast your experience, Laith Al-Saadi, with so many of the other people who've been on The Voice who are new to the business, but you certainly are not, 20 years, hundreds of gigs every year. What did you think you brought to The Voice?
Well, I like to think that I brought music that is underrepresented today, that is, I think, some of the greatest music ever made to that show. And that goes for blues, and it also goes for the classic rock of the British invasion and the Vietnam and civil rights era. I mean, for me, the period of 1965 through 1975, or let's go 64 through 74 or whatever, is probably my favorite period in the 20th century in terms of output. And there's so many reasons why. I mean, you know, I think that there was a belief that music could change the world. I think that there was a social consciousness that existed, that people were really fighting against stuff where they could see that they were making a change directly. And I mean, it was like, you know, whether it was civil rights, whether it was women's rights, whether it was Vietnam, all these things were fueling the fire of art. And art always has been a great way to usher in new ideas and represents, obviously, the philosophical changes of each time. But it's like, that was the moment. Anyway, I don't want to go on too much about it, but I just think between Motown and jazz and rock and roll and the British invasion and all that stuff, that was the time. And so I did Joe Cocker, I did the Beatles, I did Albert King and B.B. King, and I don't consider myself the savior of the blues or anything like that, which is another thing people like try to get on my case on these comments, and I hate to respond to them, but it's like, I was proud to play music that I love on that stage. I don't see myself as anything more than a vessel for stuff that I like to represent that. So if I can give more exposure to stuff that is underrepresented in today's time and culture, that makes me happy. And so I guess, in short, that's what I think I brought to the show. I think I brought music that was really important to me and who I am as a person, and was able to authentically represent myself through other people's stuff. Because as you know, I'm a singer-songwriter, so I had to use covers and the music that had influenced me that I thought was still going to resonate with people. And to see that actually work was like so gratifying. To play B.B. King and be near the top of the iTunes charts with that in a pop and country world was a wonderful thing. It was really invigorating to see that there is kind of, I mean, there's a thirst. I brought a new demographic to the show, and even the producers told me that, and I could see that glimmer of pride in their eyes because they're 50, 60 years old. I mean, I think that they don't listen to most of the music that is represented on that show, and I think that actually I made them a little bit proud. I mean, you know, I don't want to speak for them, but I mean, I could see that and hear it.
You felt that.
Yeah, I totally felt
it. Well, let's flip this around. What did being on the show do for you? What did you learn that maybe you didn't know before?
Wow. It was a big experience in terms of personal growth for me, and of course, I am not somebody that thinks about the things that one that's a TV personality thinks about. You know, it was weird to adjust to glam squads and people dressing me up and, you know, such high budget production and stuff like that. I mean, it was awesome to experience. The lighting and all the staging and all that stuff was just amazing. The production on the show was amazing to be a part of.
It certainly opened your mind to that type of thing.
Yeah,
that you don't get on a small stage in Michigan.
TV's such a strange world.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, exactly. Like, you know, even the whole, like, I normally have time before I get on a stage to have myself get composed and think clearly. And it's like they have cameras on you at all times and they want to capture nerves. And they'll actually make you pace back and forth and act like you're nervous getting ready for stuff. And it's like that may be all fake, but still that's the moment before you're getting on stage. And figuratively or whatever you want to say, it's the largest stage I've ever played on. It is not physically, but still the idea that you're being seen by 15, 16 million people when you step on there is crazy. That's more put together in one shot than my entire performing career before that. And I had played for big crowds. I was a Lions pep band singer at packed Ford Field on occasion up on the Jumbotron and stuff. Like, I'm not totally a stranger to a little bit of this, like, local level celebrity thing. But, I mean, that was national. That was, you know, really crazy to think that maybe, you know, 1/20th of this country actually knows who I am statistically.
When you look at your time through The Voice, is there a song or one moment from the show that really hit it home for you that you will always cherish?
I think actually I had a lot of those moments. One of my favorites was in the finale doing the end of Abbey Road with Adam. And the reason why I play music is because of the Beatles. And that was such a poetically just way for me to leave that journey, because it was hard. I actually wanted to play Beatles much earlier, and I think that they're not the easiest to license, and I think it was kind of a big deal, and they wanted to wait till the end, and I actually had plans to do something different. What I was hoping for was to do Let It Be by myself, and then I was going to try and have Adam and I do a Sinatra song, because I actually really wanted to sing a jazz song still. The more I thought about it, people had kind of invested and voted in this rock blues version of Laith that I thought I didn't want to do something polarizing like that. And so I thought if I were to do jazz, it would be good to have it on a song that wasn't voted on, that was just kind of fun. And I thought the coaches thing could be good for that. Well, Adam didn't want to do that, and he thought up this whole Let's Do the End of Abbey Road, because we had talked about it and both agreed that that was probably our favorite piece of recorded music in the history of recorded music. That's just a beautiful way to go out. I felt so privileged to play, again, that piece of music with an orchestra on stage, you know, and, I mean, really pull it off relatively authentically with that. The whole finale experience for me, I think, was great because I was resigned to not win. I didn't really think that I would make it as far as I did, and I think, especially because I had to do the instant save, I really felt like, okay, I'm probably not going to be in the top two in this group, but that's not really what I wanted. When I even came into it, and I know that it probably would be more beneficial to win the show and have the record contract and all that stuff, but I'm so used to running my own ship, to be honest, I didn't necessarily want to be controlled after this, and this was kind of me trying to get the most exposure that I could. So for me, finishing third or fourth was like the ideal outcome, because I'd still get to have control over my life, but I got to be in every episode up until the end of that. I got as many tracks on iTunes. I got as many people to see my stuff. And long story short, again, the finale was me kind of going out in my little blaze of rock and roll glory. I mean, I got to play Cream. I got to play the Beatles. I got to play with Joe Walsh. I mean, I got to play Georgia on My Mind. I got to play one of my favorite originals and get more eyes on my original music. And so, I mean, I just felt like I had won. I feel like actually that was probably the best outcome for me.
Just based on what I was reading on social media and the like, I think a lot of your fans were feeling the same thing. Like, yeah, we want him to win, but we really don't, because we want Laith to be Laith.
And it preserves some kind of chance of that. I mean, of course, I might not be playing for free at the local bar anymore, because I'm hoping to kind of elevate my status as an artist to being able to play more of my own music to people that want to listen instead of get drunk and talk over me. I mean, I still intend on playing a whole lot, but I want to get around the country. I want to get around the world. I want to be able to record records the way that I want to. I mean, ultimately, that's the legacy I get to leave. And it's like, you know, I mean, my last album, Real, I really did the way that I wanted to in terms of getting my favorite session players on the West Coast and using a top-notch studio. And it's great. The recording quality is great. The feeling of it is much better than a local project. But I mean, it's like, you know, I need to be able to make records of the quality that I'm capable of as an artist without being limited by financial constraints, I guess.
So the show is your, hopefully, your stepping stone to do
that. I hope so. And of course, it hasn't been yet, but I really feel like it will be. I feel like, you know, even the support I'm getting already for my upcoming shows is great.
Well, as you kind of take all of what's just happened with you on The Voice and see where that takes you, I'm getting the sense that you're such a homegrown Ann Arborite, that if you can make this happen being based in Ann Arbor, you want to do that.
I really do, and I think it's because I want to travel, and I think the more that I am going to be an international or national artist, the less it matters where I base myself out of, because that's my downtime. Before, it was a matter of making sure I made connections, and to be honest, I've put a lot of efforts into going to cities that I want to have a presence in, so I've gotten to spend a lot of time in New Orleans and L.A. I mean, I've been going to California at least 5 or 6 times a year for the last 5 years, 6 years. So basically, I felt like I would have to make myself known. I'd have to go out and get connected. And I made great connections with people in L.A. Jimmy Vivino at Conan O'Brien's a big friend of mine, and he comes to Michigan to play with me every year. But I get to play with him out there. And I made good connections before The Voice out there with the Southern California Blues Society and with different groups out there that would give me gigs. So I've always been kind of trying to spread my wings from here, but I've never really toured. This whole television thing is crazy, because now I've been exposed in places of the country that I've never even set foot in, and I might be able to go and play a theater in a place that I've never been to and have people interested in coming out to see me, and that's just crazy.
But if you just stop and you think of one Marshall Mathers and one Bob Ritchie, being Eminem and Kid Rock, who have totally made it happen.
Yep.
So
and
it's
Bob
doable.
Seger. And Bob, I mean, Seger, we've always had people that have. And the thing is, I think also Detroit has a reputation, and it's like people know. Some of the greatest musicians in the world have come from Detroit. People having to move to L.A. or New York or Nashville kind of homogenizes who they are. And I think there are regional sounds that exist in this country. And I even feel like very much in the music that I play, while it's obviously influenced by music from all over the world, it is definitely heavily influenced by music of the Midwest. Like my approach to the blues is much closer to Detroit and Chicago blues than it would be Mississippi Delta type stuff. And it's because I listen to Muddy Waters and Buddy Guy and Willie Dixon and John Lee Hooker and Albert King and all these people that were from the Midwest. And so, you know, regional sounds are a huge part of who we are. I mean, I have a big Motown influence on my stuff. I have a big funk influence, you know. I mean, Parliament and Funkadelic, George Clinton is all Detroit music. Yeah. And, you know, we have so much good stuff. I mean, the auto industry and what we had here in terms of the industrial boom brought people from the South. It brought people from all over the country. We were just such a cool melting pot culturally. And I think Detroit is something that's unique. I think Detroit needs to be represented. And, you know, Ann Arbor, I feel the same way about with its links to the Stooges, MC5, you know, Seeger, all that stuff. It's a scene I'm proud to be part of, and I hope y'all are proud to have me as part of it. But, I mean, it's something that, like, I would like to contribute to the quality and reputation of.
I want to thank you so much for spending time with us, and I hope this is not the last of our visits on Stateside. We'd love to see you back.
Well, thank you. I'd love to be back.
Laith El-Saadi, thank you so much for being with us. You're wonderful.
Thank you.
After the break, longtime school board presidents who are stepping down offer their take on education in Michigan.
You've got people who are not educators legislating how to run a business that they don't know anything about.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Help Wanted sign is out at school districts across Michigan. That's because there's a shortage of candidates for school boards. About 1,600 seats in 540 districts are up for grabs in the November election, and the filing deadline is right around the corner, July 26th. Last time around in 2014, about 70 seats in local school boards had no takers. A few weeks ago, I spoke with holders of two school board seats that will need to be filled this November. Both are longtime board members, and both have decided they're done. Carol Kleinow has served on the Utica Community School Board for 23 years, 21 of those as board president. Howard Wallach has been on the Farmington Public Schools Board since 2004. He has been president as well. And we began with this question: why Carol and Howard decided not to run for re-election?
Well, honestly, 23 years is a lot of community service, and I think I've done my fair share, and it's time to pass the baton.
How about you?
It's not that I'm not running. My term actually ends in December of 2018, so I have resigned my seat, and therefore it has to be filled by the board, and then that candidate has to run in November because of the timing of things.
Why did you resign?
Similar kind of reason, actually. I have been involved in various organizations. I'm Jewish, and I was involved in four different Jewish communal organizations for many years and took leadership roles in them and then became a school board member. So I've got about 30, 32 years of public service in one fashion or another, and just felt like it was time.
You both really have that kind of sense of it's time to lay down my arms and let someone else pick up that shield. I want to start with you, Howard. In a 12 years perspective you have on your school board, how have things changed?
I think the focus on finances has been dramatic. Obviously, it's important. We always looked at it. We spent time on it. You have to balance your budget by June 30 in Michigan under Michigan law, even though the legislature sometimes doesn't pass their budget until October or November or later, which is the craziest system you can imagine because that's where we get our money from. But the focus on finance has increased dramatically over the past 12 years. We used to have resources that we could try some experimental programs, do some innovative kinds of things. That kind of money's gone. You don't have the ability to do those kinds of things anymore. Much more time every year is spent on it because the state has the ability, even though they might tell you in May, in anticipation of you passing your June budget, that we're going to increase your allocation by $100, $150, $75 a student, they can take it back in the middle of the school year.
So you could wind up starting in the hole as the year starts?
Not could happen. It has happened to us.
That is tough. What have you seen, certainly of the perspective of your 23 years, Carol?
Howard very accurately describes what's happened. Proposal A was going to herald a whole new world of school funding in Michigan. And Proposal A, as we all know, looking back, is a funding mechanism that really works well in good times. Nobody could have anticipated the economy as things played out in the last decade in Michigan. But Proposal A just isn't working for today's economy and today's system. What I have seen is in the 90s, things were going very well. The economy is doing well. So there was good funding. But in addition, in Utica, there was rapid growth. There were years where we would grow by 500 to 700 children, which is a huge growth.
Yes.
And because the district was so large, we could take in that many kids. It was several years before we had to actually build buildings. So it was really very efficient for us, and things were good. In the last 10 years, of course, things have not been that good, again, for the reasons Howard cited. And now we are faced with not only the funding from the state not being adequate, but also we're now facing enrollment decline, as everybody else is. The birth rate went down in Macomb County for certain. I think statewide it plays out. So you're actually graduating several hundred more children than you are bringing in kindergarten. So for Utica, we're looking at about 400 children less as our students in the fall. And that has a significant impact on funding. When I read our Lansing update, at one point the governor was proposing that they would do a 50-50 split on student count to help with the declining districts. And my understanding now is they're going back to 90-10, which means for a district like Utica, 90% of the funding will be based on the fall count, which will make it very hard for us or other declining enrollment districts. That's probably $1 million swing in the budget we have to adopt June 30th, even though we don't really know what our funding's going to be. So
as you describe this, I get this image of people climbing up a wall, and that wall is loaded with grease, and you kind of see that you can't get there. As you say, as you start the year and you're already in the hole.
Well, yeah, Proposal A has been particularly bad for larger districts, mm-hmm. because when you think about it, the larger districts used to fund their districts primarily through property taxes, and their voters voted on spending money how they wanted to on schools or not. So now all of our money is going to the state, and the rural districts who have smaller populations, it's been a windfall for them. Even in bad times, they're doing much better than the bigger districts are because they're getting the same amount of allocation, yet not contributing the same amount of money to the pool. Since 2003, the cost of living increase has been about 48%. In that same time period, our school district allocation has gone up a tiny bit and then in the last several years dropped and leveled off. So it's about 16%. Before we open our doors, we're 30% behind the eight ball. And then add all of the other problems that Lansing has in terms of trying to figure out how to run the pension fund and the changes that have happened in that. When we started with Proposal A, we were contributing 5% of every dollar that we got from the state to the pension fund. Now it's up over 27, 28%. It's just not
sustainable
at all.
The other thing I'm interested in is your perspective on what you've seen over your years on the school board in terms of legislative involvement in school affairs. Carol?
I would describe it as legislative overreach in school affairs. People will talk about local control. I think Howard can certainly speak his own mind, but I think the only thing that's left for local control is what to cut. I mean, there are very few things now that a local school board can decide because most everything is legislated to the point that there's now legislation on how you evaluate your teachers, your administrators. We've gone to that level of prescription in terms of how you run your school district.
Why do you think this is? I'll make that a jump ball question. Why is this overreach the way it is?
Well, I think part of it is that there's an agenda by the leadership in Lansing about what they want to do with public education. And part of that is to get more of it into privatized schools. I think that's just absolutely clear. But what you're seeing is the attempt to implement a business model on a school system. Round peg in a square hole is the first analogy that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work. It's good in business to have all kinds of metrics and analysis and things like that, but you've got people who are not educators legislating how to run a business that they don't know anything about.
Caroline, as you look at your years, your 23 years on a school board, you're feeling problems that predate Rick Snyder's time as governor.
Again, Proposal A is primarily the driver of some of this. And I just think it took 20 years to have it kind of come to fruition in terms of what happens in a down economy. Mm-hmm. Under the Snyder administration, things have accelerated. But going back to why is all of this happening, I think it goes back further because when the Obama administration was doing Race to the Top, which was competitive funding, the state wanted to compete for those funds. And in order to be competitive for those funds, there are certain things you had to have in place. Our legislature very quickly passed the legislation to meet the criteria to apply for Race to the Top money. We never got the money, but the legislation never went away. So the teacher evaluation, some of the other things. And then the state testing, of course, the parents are starting to really push back on that issue. There's just a lot of different things that have been driven by people outside of schools. The you must start school after Labor Day. Our parents aren't really happy about that. They'd prefer to maybe have the flexibility to start in August. I mean, so those little things, when you start adding them up, there's just very little that's left for local decision making. Our community hasn't quite figured all that out. As Howard mentioned, people are taxed locally. The money goes to Lansing for the school aid fund, and then it's redistributed through the legislature. And I am quite shocked and also concerned that our local citizens will, in anger when you're cutting something that they're not happy about, will say, but I pay taxes to Utica schools. And the answer is, well, you pay taxes to schools,
right,
and the legislature decides where your money gets redistributed.
Dating right back to March 94 with Proposal mm-hmm. A.
Yeah, yes. And so they don't understand it, and they'll equate, oh, all these new homes are being built, so the school should be fine. No. So there's a lot of education in our part, and I think people just in their busy lives, especially if you have children in school, you're busy parents, I don't think they take the time to really learn about it until it affects them. And right now there's a lot of people being affected by school board decisions.
We're talking about the reality of serving on school boards mm-hmm. as we talk with mm-hmm. Carol Kleena of the Utica Community School Board. She served for 23 years. Howard Wallach is with us with the Farmington Public Schools Board since 2004. Both not going to be continuing. Howard has resigned his seat. Carol, you are not going to run for re-election. And we know tough decisions have got to be made by school boards, whether it's closing a school or cut an effective program. Howard, what's the most difficult decision you've had to make?
Our board has gone through this now twice. The first time that we talked about privatization was about 3 or 4 years ago. We decided not to at that time. Our bargaining units were able to make concessions that made things work. And when you do that, you affect people whose jobs you are taking. You affect the community because in our district, many of our employees live in our district at all levels, whether they're bus drivers, custodians, teachers, administrators. And they rightfully say, you know, my little Johnny knows the bus driver, and I know that that bus driver's going to be safe, driving safely with my child. And you're going to bring in people from the outside and all of those kinds of arguments. I think that's probably the toughest decision we have to make because you have to look squarely at people who you know and you like and you've seen and maybe have driven your kids or you work with if they're a custodian or a lunch person. So taking a person's job away is a very, very difficult one. Let me tag on to what Carol said a minute ago because you were asking about, you know, it's not all on Snyder's watch, mm-hmm. and I couldn't agree more. There's bipartisanship in terms of the problem that has gone on here. I'm going to take you back to 1994 when Governor Engler supported the change in public funding of schools with Proposal A. But there was a special exemption, and it was a line item called 20J in the budget. And 20J was a allocation that said, essentially, if your school district is already spending more money because your voters approved it than what the state's going to allocate, we're not going to take that money away from you. So we got about $2,000 per student for many years that other districts didn't have because we were already supporting our kids at a higher level. And in the swoop of a pen, Governor Granholm took that away from us 1 year because the school aid fund and the budget in general was in such bad shape. And that happened in October after we've already written our budget and approved it as required by law in June. It can be disastrous, and that year was.
What's your toughest decision in a nutshell, Carol?
I think any decision that has to do with people losing their jobs, I would rank the worst. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with Howard. However, there's another side of the school board that is not as well observed, and that is when you have to render judgment in an appeal of an expulsion. I really find those difficult because in that setting, you have a family with their child who did something, probably a poor decision. Often it's a good kid who just made a poor decision that one day, and the consequences are dire. And when you're sitting there listening to the family kind of explain the rationale for why we shouldn't uphold the recommendation to expel their child, it is just very, very difficult. Most times the facts are clear and you still have to uphold that expulsion decision or recommendation. Your heart goes out to them, and you do know that kids can just get a wild idea and do something, not thinking long term. And those to me are also very, very difficult decisions for a board.
Are either of you surprised there's a shortage of people willing to run for school boards in Michigan?
Absolutely not.
Not at all. I think it might fit the definition of thankless job. I don't know. I'm sure there's other jobs out there, but there's less and less influence on what you can do in the school district. You're not really shaping the district's direction to the extent you could have back when I first started on the school board. It's just much more difficult and hard to find that intrinsic satisfaction because you're just making decisions that are painful.
I think there's another component, too, to that. The notion that what we see play out on the news every night about people in Lansing and people in Washington who are politicians and their behavior, some of which is very bad, trickles down into the local community where now, although we can't raise a millage for operations, we might have to have a millage for a bond or buildings or technology or those kinds of things. And they're going to come to your school board and they're going to start screaming at you. And what do you see on TV at 11 o'clock is that little soundbite where somebody's screaming at a school board. And people are sitting back and saying, why would I take that job? Why would I stick my neck out and have to take that abuse when all they're trying to do is the best they can under the circumstances that exist at the time? I fully understand people aren't going to like every decision I make. And you know that going into taking this position. But it's a far cry from I disagree with you to abusiveness. And I think people see that that happens and they say there's no reason for me to take time away from my family or from my work or anything else that I'm doing.
Bottom line, as we wrap up, what will it mean if not enough people are willing to step up and take those empty seats on school boards?
I think one of the things that you'll see is single agenda individuals who can rally the troops, so to speak, on that agenda and don't really have the agenda of public education first in their mind being elected, maybe only once. But now they'll have several years to kind of wreak havoc on what's going on and perhaps try to undo things that other school boards voted upon. It could be anything from you decide to close a building or to reorganize or to do other kinds of things, eliminate programs if you, God forbid, have to. And they say, no, we're bringing that back. And they don't understand that when you push the balloon on this side, there's a reaction on the other end, or they don't care.
I agree. I also think there's kind of a trickle down that will begin to happen. You cannot run an organization when the governing body is dysfunctional. So over time, it does catch up with the reputation, community perception, and a school district that has a dysfunctional board, I believe, will begin to lose students because the community will lose confidence. However, I think another trickle down or perhaps unforeseen consequences, then it begins to affect the quality of the leadership of the school district that you hire. For example, if you have boards with single issue, I absolutely agree, single issue people that really don't care about the overall strategic direction, the long-term health of the district, they're just there for their issue, it's going to be harder and harder to find quality superintendents or first-line executive leadership in school districts. We already see some of that today. It's very hard to find superintendents who are talented and qualified. The pool, I mean, you can find them, but it's just not the same number of applicants that you would have found, say, 15 or 20 years ago. So the difficulty with boards, I think, does affect the long-term leadership in the school districts, too. So, and that concerns me.
Absolutely.
We need good brains. We need good talent in schools.
Carol Kleino has been on the Utica Community School Board for 23 years, 21 of those as board president. Howard Wallach has served on the Farmington Public Schools Board since 2004. Thanks to both of you for giving us a sense of what it's like to be on a school board in Michigan. It was great to meet you. Thank you.
I have to congratulate Carol. 21 years as president is just amazing. I think I'm in my third or fourth term as president, and I thought that was a lot. You're amazing.
You know, I still love the work, though. I really do. It's been very rewarding, and despite all the things we said that makes it difficult, I still highly recommend people think about it because most of the time it's more rewarding than it is challenging.
Agreed.
Thanks to both of
you. And you meet some great people.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's engineer was Bob Skong. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.